You can find information about subscribing to this series at netrf.org/podcast, where you'll also find helpful charts, graphs, and videos that expand on this material. If you're new to NetWise, we strongly recommend you go back and listen to the series from the beginning, starting with episode 1. It will give you a solid grounding in the basics of neuroendocrine tumors and how they're treated. You can find the whole series at netrf.org/podcast and wherever you get your podcasts. Do you have a story to tell about your own NET journey? If you're a NET patient who would like to participate in a future episode, please email us and let us know. podcast@netrf.org. Welcome to NETWISE. This is a podcast for neuroendocrine cancer patients and caregivers that presents expert information and patient perspectives. My name is Elise Gellerman from the Neuroendocrine Tumor Research Foundation. On today's NETWISE, we're going to dive into the relationship between cancer and genetics. There's still a lot we don't know about how the genetic code you were born with affects the likelihood that you will develop neuroendocrine cancer, but there are some cases where we can identify a very clear connection. This can have very important implications for treatment strategies, prognosis, and the health of other members of your family. To understand this, let's start with some basics about the relationship between cancer and DNA. Cancers begin in the body because of some kind of genetic mutation, a modification in a cell or group of cells that allows them to multiply and form a tumor. Often this mutation doesn't cause cell multiplication exactly, but rather turns off a mechanism that prevents cell multiplication. Here's Gretchen Thone, a genetic counselor at Geisinger Medical Center in Danville, Pennsylvania.
So they're supposed to be acting in a certain way, almost like a brake on like a car to say, okay, this cell is not functioning. It's not doing what it's supposed to be doing on a day-to-day basis. It's a little out of control. So what's going on with it? And that gene is supposed to stop that and say, okay, this cell, we need to look at it. We need to handle it in some way. But if there's a genetic change that actually impacts the way that that gene is functioning, it's not going to be able to stop that cell from growing. So then it grows out of control.
These mutations can be grouped into two large categories: hereditary mutations, also called germline mutations, which are passed down from parents to children, and somatic mutations, which pop up sporadically in a person's body, unrelated to their DNA at birth. Here's Dr. Lauren Fishbein, an endocrinologist at the University of Colorado.
Most neuroendocrine tumors are sporadic, meaning they do not have a hereditary genetic component. In those cases, what happens is one cell in the body develops a change in the DNA that we call a mutation, but just one cell, let's say in the pancreas or the small intestine, that develops a mutation and develops in a tumor. So that's a somatic tumor-specific change.
And unfortunately, in the case of most NETs, we really don't know what causes the somatic mutations that result in their growth.
It's different than lung cancer, where we can attribute a lot to smoking, melanoma, or other skin cancer, where we can contribute a lot to DNA damage from the sun's UV rays. For neuroendocrine tumors, we really don't know the answer to that.
In some cases, though, we're able to point to a particular germline mutation as a primary factor in someone developing NETs. To the best of our knowledge, some kind of hereditary mutation causes up to 15% of pancreatic NETs and 30 to 40% of pheochromocytomas and paragangliomas, rare NETs that grow in the body's adrenal system.
The hereditary mutations, they're caused by changes in our DNA that we are born with. So those changes in the DNA are present in every cell of our body, and they predispose us to get one of these neuroendocrine tumors. It doesn't mean the person will get a neuroendocrine tumor, it just means they're at higher risk to potentially develop one.
We describe people who have an identifiable germline mutation that affects their health as having a genetic syndrome. And there are several syndromes that have been identified as causes of NETs. Let's talk about some of the most prevalent, one by one. All of these are rare conditions, The most common is called multiple endocrine neoplasia type 1, or MEN1, which affects around 1 in every 30,000 people.
The gene is called MEN1, and it makes a protein called menin. And there's still a lot of research going on for exactly what menin does, but one of its roles is as a modifier for how our chromatin, which is our DNA, folds and is controlled in our cells. And so if there's a mutation in the MEN1 gene, the menin protein can't function properly. And we're okay with having just one copy of menin in our cells. So remember, we inherit two copies of every gene and protein, one from mom, one from dad. And if someone's born with predisposition for MEN1, that means every cell in their body is missing one copy already. And luckily, our cells still function with just one good copy. But if a particular cell in our body, by chance, that good copy of MEN1 gene gets damaged, then that cell can't operate correctly because it's missing menin, the protein from MEN1 gene. And so that is what predisposes to tumors. And there are certain cells or tissues in our body that are more susceptible. And that's where we find the tumors, like in the pancreas is more susceptible. The parathyroid glands are more susceptible, et cetera.
Here's Dr. Mark Lewis, an oncologist at Intermountain Healthcare in Utah. As we heard in an earlier episode of this series, he is himself a NET patient with MEN1.
The sort of problem that MEN1 patients deal with is sometimes remembered by the mnemonic, the three Ps. So it's three organs that are affected, and they're all in the midline. So pancreas, parathyroid, and then pituitary. So all of us will have parathyroid problems. Some of us will have pancreas problems, and probably the minority of us with MEN1 will have pituitary problems. But those are the three Ps.
The first and most prevalent of these 3P problem areas for MEN1 patients is the parathyroid, specifically a condition called hyperparathyroidism. While this isn't itself a NET condition, it's one that NET patients with MEN1 absolutely need to be aware of because, as Dr. Lewis said, nearly all of them will develop this condition sometime in their lives. At its core, it's an imbalance in the way the body handles calcium.
98% of our calcium at any one time is stored in our skeleton, and that's great. That's what gives us form. Otherwise, we'd be sort of a puddle on the floor. But 2% of our calcium at any given time is in the bloodstream, and it's an extremely careful balance. There's four parathyroid glands. They're the drivers of how quickly calcium is released from your bones into your bloodstream. Hyperparathyroidism just means that at least one of them is overactive.
Out of control activity in one or more of these glands can cause calcium to move too quickly out of the bones and into the bloodstream, causing problems like kidney stones when the excess calcium builds up in places it shouldn't, and also compromising the health of the bones.
Not only does your blood calcium go up, but your bone calcium goes down. So when I was actually found to have MEN1 at the age of 30, I already had osteoporosis, and that's a condition a lot of people associate with aging, but it can happen in very young people if the parathyroid balance is out of whack.
Around 40% of MEN1 patients also develop the second of those characteristic Ps, pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. We've talked about PNETs a lot in this series, and we need to spend some more time with them here because the PNETs caused by MEN1 have some very distinctive characteristics. First, they often form what we call multifocal primary tumors. This means that rather than one single primary tumor that then might metastasize and form secondary tumors elsewhere, many small tumors develop all at once in the original site.
It's very common to see in those who have MEN1, they can have a single pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor, but it's not uncommon to see multiple small pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors in those with MEN1. And that can be challenging. And that's partly why the guidelines for the pancreatic neuroendocrine part of MEN1 suggest kind of watching and monitoring when those tumors are very small, because we know that a lot of patients will have these multiple small tumors that maybe will hopefully never grow or change. And so we can watch them over time. The only way to cure someone when they have multiple would be to remove the whole pancreas, which is a big surgery and can have a lot of consequences. Can be done, and patients can live very well without a pancreas. Luckily, we can replace the enzymes and the hormones needed. But you know, we want to avoid that if we can. And so guidelines really do recommend surgery at certain sizes that the pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors get to, especially when there's multiple of them.
People with MEN1 are also more likely to develop gastrinomas of the pancreas, functional peanuts that produce excesses of gastrin, a hormone which causes the body to make stomach acid.
And so there can be gastrinomas in patients who don't have MEN1, but if there is someone who has a gastrinoma, their chance of having MEN1 is a little bit higher. And so gastrinomas can form from cells in the pancreas and also cells in the duodenum at the end of the stomach, beginning of the intestine. And those gastrinomas tumors can make very high levels of gastrin, causing severe heartburn that can be very difficult to control. We can use antacid medicines like proton pump inhibitors, PPIs, to help control the acid. But for some people, even with high dose of those medications, it can be difficult to control the acid levels. And so this can be a challenge for patients with MEN1, especially if they happen to have multifocal disease, because then which one of these little tumors is the one that's over making gastrin? And so that can be challenging sometimes from a therapeutic standpoint.
About a third of MEN1 patients also develop a cancer called pituitary adenoma, which is the third of those three Ps, and other tumors are possible as well.
There are other conditions associated with MEN1, including other neuroendocrine tumors. And so people with MEN1 can be at increased risk for developing lung or bronchial neuroendocrine tumors, as well as thymic neuroendocrine tumors. They can also be at increased risk for developing adrenal nodules or tumors, which tend to be benign. And there's also discussion of whether breast cancer is at increased risk for those with MEN1 or not. That data and that research is still ongoing.
MEN1 and some of the other hereditary syndromes we'll discuss in this episode are conditions requiring constant surveillance, making people who have it need frequent scans and lab tests throughout their lives in order to be on the lookout for any of the many types of cancer that may occur.
My name is John Metzkar. I am 40 years old. I am in Bloomington, Indiana, and I have MEN1. It really starts with my sister. In the mid-2000s, my sister was having problems in her abdominal region. And, you know, just no solution, not sure what's going on. And then the results came back positive for pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. And then she already pieced together from my mom's history of having parathyroid adenoma, a pituitary adenoma, that we must have MEN1 in the family. So that's kind of how we found out. That was in 2008. And then things kind of accelerated over a couple of years as like my mom got into screening and surveillance, and extensive disease was revealed at that point in time in terms of pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. You know, I got involved in surveillance eventually, and then was shown to have, you know, at least a couple problems in 2010. But I was reluctant to get it. My sister really pushed everybody actually to get this looked at. So to have the best care possible, even though it's scary to know all this, at least now I have choices. I can go in informed and make the best choices that are available to me. And I've had several of the manifestations of MEN1. So I had a bronchial carcinoid that was diagnosed in 2010 and was removed with a surgery. And at the same time that I was diagnosed with bronchial carcinoid, and while that was of the most concern to the care team, it was also apparent that I had pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. And so I had a distal pancreatectomy in 2014. In terms of treatment, I'm looking at, I get 6 months serial PET CTs, so that's the NET spot, the gallium dotatate scans. And so then basically a treatment decision is made every 6 months. Right now I am on everolimus, I started an online retinoid and that wasn't getting the control that my oncologist wanted. And I tolerated it well after we had a little bit of a dose reduction. It was hard at first, but I mean, you know, working with the team, we got it dialed in and I have almost no problems. And so then next up will probably be PRRT is what I assume.
In addition to MEN1, there's another rarer genetic condition called MEN2, which affects a different gene and presents a different set of problems.
So MEN1 and MEN2, it's almost unfortunate in my mind that they are named so similarly because they really are very, very different conditions. And I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of confusion even among physicians about how related or unrelated they are. Just like MEN1 has this dominant hyperparathyroidism, the dominant feature of MEN2 is medullary thyroid cancer. Some of those mutations are so scary and threatening that the risk of cancer starts almost at birth, and you really have to consider doing thyroid surgery within that first year of life, which is a huge decision for parents to make, as you might imagine, but sometimes a life-saving one for that affected child. The other aspects of MEN2 can include hyperparathyroidism again, and then a nasty problem called pheochromocytoma.
Pheochromocytoma and a related kind of cancer called paraganglioma, often referred to as pheos and paras, are types of neuroendocrine tumors that develop in and around the body's adrenal system. Pheos grow inside the adrenal glands, and paras can grow elsewhere in the body. They're very often functional tumors, producing excess adrenaline in the system, which creates a distinct and challenging set of symptoms.
You can end up with extremely high blood pressure. Imagine being sort of in a fight or flight situation all the time and unpredictably. And so patients get horrible pounding in their chest, their heart just palpitating. They can get very, very sweaty and get horrible headaches from elevated high blood pressure.
Pheos and paras can be caused by MEN2 and also by a number of other genetic syndromes. Here's Dr. Joseph Dillon, an endocrinologist at the University of Iowa.
About 40% of pheos and paras have a genetic predisposition, and in all, upwards of 20 genes have been isolated. Now, some of those genes have been isolated in only, you know, one or two families. So of the other genes that have been isolated that drive pheos and paras, one of the big groups of genes is called the SDH genes. And those, you know, the 40% of people who have pheos and paras with genetic abnormality, probably about 15% have SDH genes. And there are five known SDH genes, A, B, C, D, and AF2. I'm not sure why they didn't just call it E, but of these group of genes, the SDHB genes tend to have more pheochromocytomas and abdominal and chest paragangliomas. Upwards of 30% of them can metastasize, be typical malignant cancers. Whereas if you look at the SDHA or the SDHC, people who have those genetic abnormalities more frequently get paragangliomas of the head and neck area, and they do not tend to be malignant or metastasize widely. So very different behavior from genes that are even closely related, because they're all related to this SDH, which is an enzyme within the mitochondria of these cells. Up to 85% of people who have specific SDH genes will get some pheochromocytoma or paraganglioma during their lifetime.
The last genetic condition we'll describe in detail today is called von Hippel-Lindau syndrome, or VHL. VHL affects around 10,000 people in the United States at any given time, and can be the cause of a number of neuroendocrine cancers, including pancreatic NETs, pheos, and paras.
Similar to MEN1, we all have two copies of our VHL gene, and someone who has VHL is born with just one functional copy in all their cells. And again, luckily enough, that one copy is enough, but if some particular cell picks up a mutation in the one good copy, that can lead to a tumor. The VHL gene is involved in controlling the hypoxia pathway in our cell. So it regulates what is called a hypoxia-inducible factor. And that hypoxia-inducible factor goes on to regulate a whole set of genes in the cell. So VHL is kind of a master regulator of this hypoxia pathway. And so when that VHL protein isn't working because there's a mutation, that can lead to cells growing and tumors forming.
My name is Doug Carl. I live in Minnesota and 48 years old. My diagnosis of VHL was at age 43. Woke up on a Saturday morning. My wife and the kids were out of town and my right leg was completely numb. I was doing some work in the house and I figured, you know, I pinched a nerve or I did something. So started driving to the grocery store to get some food for breakfast. And then my left hand went completely weak, just nothing. It just dropped. And so, you know, drove myself to the emergency room and I had 8 bilateral strokes. And so I go through this 3-month misdiagnosis period. You know, yeah, maybe it's lymphoma, could be leukemia, could be acute, could be chronic. Had multiple biopsies that took place during that time. And during this, they identified some masses on my adrenal glands. And within, you know, 2 weeks, they had it figured out, and it was bilateral pheochromocytoma. And so I got my testing done, got the results back, and I have VHL. The best way that I can characterize VHL is cancer for life. Someone unfortunately gets, you know, a normal cancer, and you know, then they get to their 5-year all clear and they're good to go. For us, these tumors continue to pop up and grow in different areas of the body. So I just had spinal surgery to remove a hemangioblastoma on my spine. I had a T10 to T12 laminectomy. And then there's other smaller items that are on my spine as well. Yeah, I've got lesions on my pancreas, one kidney, and liver. I've got a paraganglioma. And you know, literally, I mean, it's like once a year I'll go through and just chart down like all the stuff that's on the list and the size of it and, you know, where it's currently graded. It's been an interesting emotional journey. You know, the reality of, you know, what people refer to as scanxiety is there. Every year I go in for, you know, 3 MRIs. And, you know, the first couple of years, it was really difficult. Over time, it's like, I don't sweat what the results are going to be. It's gotten to the point, and it's going to sound silly, but I sweat the inconvenience of sitting in the tube for 3-4 hours, you know, however long it is to get all these things done. So, you know, that part has gotten easier where it becomes more difficult is my soon to be 12-year-old son. He also has VHL. And one of my sisters has VHL as well. And so after I got tested, then the kids got tested, my mom got tested, and all my siblings did. My dad passed away in 2000, and he appeared to be the carrier. And so the caregiver side, I think, is the hardest because you can't control what they have to deal with. So my son, this will actually be his first year going into the tube. And that's a tough thing.
We do recommend testing children for MEN1 and VHL as screening guidelines start fairly early. We start looking at prolactin and insulin and glucose at like 5. And we even recommend a head MRI at 5 years of age. And that's hard for parents. And I have a few right now that it's an ongoing conversation. And, you know, you're just as supportive as you can. And as for me, I know I've definitely recommended, like, even if you don't want to do testing, like, let's just get this recommended, the screening guidelines, like what they say, let's just start that. We can take this one step at a time, but like, we need to make sure that everything is okay and they're safe. But yeah, it gets tricky for sure. And there's a lot of different reasons. I mean, sometimes a lot of it is guilt too. Like they feel so bad about their child inheriting this genetic change. And I just really talked to them a lot about how there's nothing that they could have done. So really just addressing the whole family as one and, you know, helping to support them through that whole process of testing. And then if it comes back positive, you know, being supportive in the next best step with like the specialist they would need to see and the screening options that they have. So it's definitely a lot.
Dr. Lewis's son also has MEN1.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, you know, so we tested him when he was two. Obviously, that was not when we told him. But essentially, I don't know about you, I can sort of start to remember things maybe when I was around four. And so we basically, when he started going to the doctor at that age, just made it a part of his checkup. And that way, it wasn't something so foreign to him. And I really hate the phrase new normal. I think I've heard that way too much during COVID. But again, normalizing for him, an abnormal condition is the way I would put it.
Even for families who don't realize they carry this condition until all the children are grown, this is an emotionally difficult situation for parents and children alike.
My mom is receiving treatment. My impression is that, you know, there was some element of sorrow, of grieving, and doubly for her. Because, of course, this isn't the kind of thing that you want as a parent to have for your children. And then, you know, as the carrier of the mutation, I think was even harder on her. And at the same time, I think she really reflected on all the joy that she had at, you know, being a parent and having children, having successful children, that, you know, of course, I don't think she would have done it any other way. And I think that reflects this experience that we all have, where it's a mix sometimes it's a mix of the best of things and the worst of things. And it you know, it's hard. It's life. In some aspects, there's ways in which, not to be too hyperbolic about it, but there's some aspects of which having this kind of chronic disease that we know isn't going to go away, it can highlight everything. I believe that's reflected in her experience as well.
Perhaps the toughest set of decisions is for a person who has received a diagnosis of a serious hereditary condition and doesn't yet have children of their own. Should they have kids, knowing they have a 50% chance of those children being born with this syndrome?
And everybody approaches this differently. You know, my wife and I decided to end up having children. I think right after my diagnosis, I was reluctant. I had been interested in having children, and I was reluctant to after that. So I have a child, I have a daughter. She's negative for the mutation. So it certainly simplifies her life. But we would have been ready to handle it. I mean, that's the decision that we, you know, we had to be comfortable with either outcome. And I think that our take on it was that the treatments had been successful, and that when we looked at other members of the community, they'd lived good lives, and in fact were continuing to live good lives. And furthermore, that when it came to some of the most pernicious aspects of MEN1, like the malignancies, that treatments were improving. There was something more every day, and that we could see that my mom had been successfully treated. And so we just decided that it was worth it, and that we would be without regrets. So I guess another way to put it is we might be with more regrets if we didn't go with children.
There are also options for having children without sharing this particular gene with them, such as conceiving by in vitro fertilization and pretesting the embryos. But these can be complicated, expensive, and fraught with ethical issues. It's a subject for careful conversations with your family and care team. Overall, the case for being screened for these conditions when you know there is a history of them in your family is fairly clear. Knowing you have a syndrome like MEN1 or von Hippel-Lindau as early as possible can improve your long-term care enormously.
For all these genetic hereditary conditions, the key, I think, is knowledge, and knowledge is power. So if someone knows they have a genetic predisposition of some sort, then it allows them with their providers to do the appropriate screening so that these associated conditions can be picked up early. And again, this is true for all of these hereditary conditions. And the key is early diagnosis so that there can be surgical cures when it's still at a relatively, no surgery is easy, but relatively easier time for tumor removal.
But what if you have a tumor that might be caused by a hereditary condition, such as a pancreatic NET or a pheochromocytoma, but don't have a known history of one of these conditions in your family? Should you be screened for them just in case? That's a more complicated question.
Only maybe 10, maybe 15% of everyone with a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor is going to have a hereditary predisposition. And so there are guidelines from the American College of Medical Genetics, and they recommend that just having a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor alone is not enough to necessarily screen for one of these hereditary conditions. However, if you have a gastrinoma type, the one that's making the high gastrin and causing the severe acid and heartburn, then those people should be screened for MEN1. Or if you have a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor and one of the other features of either MEN1 or VHL, et cetera, then they should be tested for it. But usually a single pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor alone without any of these other features is not usually enough to trigger the need for genetic testing. And for pheopera, it's as high as 40% of those. So for pheopera, we do recommend that anyone with pheopera be screened for a genetic cause.
We live in a time when home genetic testing has become very available. One thing we strongly recommend is to not try to interpret genetic risk factors without the help of a doctor or genetic counselor who really understands what the results mean and can help you determine what is a genuine cause for concern and what is not.
If someone is interested in knowing about themselves, then that's their right. But also, I really, really encourage people to have some kind of physician or genetic counselor that they can talk to about what these results are, because I feel like people go into like direct consumer testing and they have no idea what could come up from it. And so many things are looked at and they're just little risk factors, and it's going to mean a different thing to a different person. They're just looking at little changes that, you know, could even be seen in the general population that just increase your risk, but it's not anything that I would want a patient to stress over. Like, I would really want them to come and like talk to us and have that support person to go through those results.
I am a huge proponent for genetic testing. I do believe knowledge is power, but we do have to use it in a thoughtful way so that we know what we're looking for and we can deal with the potential incidental findings. So we do need to be thoughtful about how we do our genetic testing.
All in all, there's still quite a lot we don't know about genetic causes of NETs, and it's quite possible that there are hereditary conditions that we have not yet discovered. And as researchers learn more and more, it may open the doors for new knowledge and new treatments for NET patients with genetic syndromes.
Now, we do know that sometimes there are families that seem to have the same small intestine tumor in the families, but they do not have a known genetic predisposition or a germline mutation. So there probably are genes or causes that we have not identified yet as scientists and physicians that do lead to hereditary conditions that we don't know about yet. And so this is an ongoing field of research and discovery.
Thanks for listening to NetWise. My name is Elise Gellerman from the Neuroendocrine Tumor Research Foundation. This episode was produced by David Hoffman of Citizen Racecar, assisted by Garrett Tiedemann and Charlotte Moore. It was made possible by the generous support of Ipsen Biopharmaceuticals and Tercera Therapeutics. Special thanks to everyone we interviewed for this episode. We are grateful for your expertise. This is a production of the Neuroendocrine Tumor Research Foundation, where we're committed to improving the lives of patients, families, and caregivers affected by neuroendocrine cancer by funding research to discover cures and more effective treatments and providing information and educational resources. Please visit us at netrf.org.
This podcast is not intended as and shall not be relied upon as medical advice. The Neuroendocrine Tumor Research Foundation encourages all listeners to discuss any scientific information found here with their personal oncologist, physician, and/or appropriate qualified health professional. Listening to this podcast does not constitute a patient-physician relationship. The Neuroendocrine Tumor Research Foundation does not represent that any information provided here should supplant the reasoned, informed advice of a patient's personal oncologist, physician, or appropriate qualified health professional.